Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world. Produced on WSCA LP, 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, November 5th, 2011. Happy Move Your Money Day. Today is a day when you are encouraged to cut your ties with big banks and put your money into credit unions and community banks. Moving on, here's what we have coming up on Making Waves. After News You Need to Know with Steve Diamond, we hear a Between the Lines interview about the latest in the Occupy Wall Street movement. Another Between the Lines interview tells us about the threats to Social Security posed by the Congressional Super Committee. Media Minutes brings us news at the intersection of media and democracy. Hidden Histories reminds us of the origins of Veterans Day. Then Outside the Box with Larry Danziger asks some challenging questions about voting and political parties. We'll also have music and more, so stay with us. First, for some news.
This is Steve Diamond with News You Need to Know. This week, focusing on Afghanistan theater expenses. That's a double entendre that will soon become clear. But first, a little bit of background on recent developments in Afghanistan, from CNN on October 29th. At least 13 U.S. troops were killed in Kabul when a suicide bomber struck a NATO military convoy. The attack was one of two targeting NATO-led forces that day. A gunman in southern Afghanistan wearing an Afghan army uniform turned his weapon on coalition forces during training, killing two. In yet another suicide attack in northeastern Afghanistan, a woman in a burqa detonated herself near the nation's intelligence agency. And now a correction on that story from antiwar.com on October 30th. Yesterday's suicide bombing attack on a NATO convoy killed at least 12 Americans, but they weren't U.S. soldiers. At least eight were members of the massive force of U.S. government contractors. The number of mercenaries working for the U.S. military in Afghanistan is at least as large as the number of U.S. soldiers there. And now our lead story from McClatchy Newspapers on November 3rd. With U.S. Ambassador Carl Eikenberry in town, the newly installed Afghan provincial governor arranged for a surprise. Two Taliban insurgents would drop in on a ceremony in Eikenberry's honor, lay down their weapons, and pledge to support the government in front of a large crowd of dignitaries. But no one informed the huge force of U.S. and Afghan soldiers who were guarding the event at the governor's compound last December. Afghan security forces seized and held the two men, armed and dressed in black, at a checkpoint. Later, it got more embarrassing for the governor, Musa Khan, when U.S. officials learned that he and another official had recruited and paid the men to show up in a bid to curry favor with Eikenberry. The governor was trying to fool the Americans. The aborted, staged incident was the closest that the eastern province of Ghazni has come to officially disarming a Taliban fighter. No rebel fighter in this province has been formally enrolled in the U.S.-backed process known as reintegration, a linchpin of American and NATO efforts to end the decade-long war in Afghanistan. Ghazni's reintegration program is a tale of questionable theatrics, dashed hopes, wasted money, official dysfunction, and deepening fears that the so-called insurgency is growing more potent. The peace process, by nearly all accounts, is failing. Over the past year, the coalition has invested increasing time and money in a two-part peace process authorized by Karzai. Negotiating truces with rebel commanders and reintegrating low-level fighters into society by forgiving their rebel activities and providing them with jobs. Donor nations have poured $142 million into an Afghan-run fund to provide fighters with jobs and other incentives, but barely one-fifth has been spent because of administrative hurdles and political foot-dragging. Even less has trickled down to the provinces, where local officials say they can't promise sufficient work opportunities or protection for the former Taliban. To Ghazni's east are the mountainous provinces that border Pakistan, where coalition forces are engaged in increasingly heavy fighting. Security in Ghazni seems to be deteriorating amid a rash of targeted killings and roadside bombs. The United States remains committed to the reintegration process, with $50 million more in U.S. money pledged for 2012. East of the town of Ghazni, a U.S. provincial reconstruction team continues to finance work on a school that's meant to serve as a vocational training center for former combatants. Built by another U.S. team several years ago, but never used, the long V-shaped facility had fallen into disrepair, its windows smashed and plumbing clogged. Stung by its cost, Americans in Ghazni dubbed the building, quote, the $1.2 million monument to failure. This year, U.S. officials spent $120,000 to clean up the place and install a generator, water pump, guard tower, and front gate. Work is expected to finish by December in the hope that provincial officials will begin to enroll former fighters early next year. So far, not one potential student has been identified. And from antiwar.com on October 28th. A new CNN-ORC international poll shows that the opposition to the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan has grown to a record high, with 63% of the American public now firmly opposed to the conflict. The open-ended nature of the war and its repeated escalation has destroyed public support, and another question shows a solid majority of 58% of Americans believe Afghanistan has turned into another Vietnam. Early in 2011, U.S. officials began claiming major progress was being made, but it is clear that people no longer believe those claims. And this from antiwar.com and Politico on November 4th. Major General Peter Fuller, one of the top U.S. Army commanders in Afghanistan, was fired today for, quote, inappropriate public comments related to criticism of Hamid Karzai in an interview Thursday with Politico. Fuller condemned the Afghan government as, quote, isolated from reality, and expressed hope that he would be replaced by, quote, a guy that's more articulate in public in the next election. In the interview with Politico, Fuller slammed Karzai's recent remark that Afghanistan would side with Pakistan in a war against the U.S., blasting the comments as erratic and adding, quote, why don't you just poke me in the eye with a needle? You've got to be kidding me. I'm sorry, we just gave you $11.6 billion and now you're telling me I don't really care? He repeatedly said the Afghan leaders don't appreciate the sacrifice that the U.S. was making in blood and treasure for the sake of their country. Fuller has served in the armed forces for more than 30 years. So while telling the truth in the U.S. military can get you fired, as this next story shows, telling the right lies has no such risk. From antiwar.com on November 4th. In comments today, an unnamed U.S. military official termed Iran, quote, the biggest threat to the U.S. and to our interests. Comments that add all the more speculation about a potential U.S. or Israeli attack on the nation. At the same time, the official conceded that Iran doesn't want to provoke a conflict and that the U.S. doesn't know if Iran has decided to make a nuclear weapon, despite repeated allegations that they not only have decided to do so, but are nearing completion. But U.S. officials have been making those claims for decades, always saying that Iran is a couple of years away from a weapon, even though one is never actually completed. The U.S. has been threatening to attack Iran virtually nonstop since the Iranian Revolution. And from antiwar.com on October 30th. The New York Times reports that the Obama administration is planning a massive troop surge into Kuwait and the surrounding region, as well as a major naval buildup in international waters in the area. The new surge certainly has one eye on Iraq, where violence is still high and where the U.S. has built a Vatican-sized embassy, filled with its own private contractor army for the State Department. But the other eye is squarely on Iran. Former Defense Secretary Gates even argued in his final major policy speech that the U.S. should keep troops in Iraq to, quote, make Iran uncomfortable. But the fallback plan is now to try to dramatically increase military ties with some of the most brutal regimes in the region, including Bahrain, fresh off their brutal crackdown on pro-democracy protesters. Torture of Bahraini detainees was systemic, according to a recent independent human rights probe. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton defended the escalation plans, saying it was, quote, proof of our ongoing commitment to Iraq and to the future of the region, which holds such promise and should be freed from outside interference to continue on the pathway to democracy. It must be hard to say things like that with a straight face. I guess Clinton considers Iraq to be part of the U.S. now. That's the only way invading and occupying the country can be downgraded to merely internal interference. And this from an article by Ron Paul on antiwar.com. Upward of 17,000 military personnel and private security contractors will remain in Iraq. This is still a significant American footprint in the country. And considering that a private security contractor costs the U.S. taxpayer about three times as much as a soldier, we're not going to see any real cost savings. The administration fully intends to keep troops in Iraq indefinitely under a new agreement, while the Iraqis are doing their best to assert their sovereignty. And finally, from CNN on October 31st, UN agency UNESCO voted to accept a Palestinian bid for full membership as a new member state. The vote, which requires two-thirds approval, passed with 107 votes in favor, 14 against, and 52 abstentions. Huge applause broke out at UNESCO's meeting in Paris when the results of the vote were announced. The vote risks the agency, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, losing its U.S. funding, which accounts for more than a fifth of its budget. Sure enough, U.S. funding was immediately cut after the announcement of the vote. Hanan Ashrawi, a member of the Palestinian Liberation Organization's executive committee, said by phone, "This is a significant victory and sends a clear message to those who are trying to hold history and deny the rights of Palestinians that there are a majority of nations with conscience who refuse to be intimidated and blackmailed. The ones who voted negatively are isolating themselves, along with Israel, on the wrong side of justice and the law. And if the U.S. continues to threaten to boycott or withdraw from organizations that recognize Palestine, it might find itself outside most global institutions with diminishing influence and standing," she said. The Israeli representative addressing the meeting after the vote said UNESCO has, quote, "adopted the science fiction version of reality by admitting a non-existent state," close quote. The U.S. representative said the U.S., quote, "cannot accept the premature admission of Palestine into the organization." So the official U.S. position is essentially that Palestine should eventually be recognized as a state once Israel approves, which will never happen since Israel has abandoned peace moves and claims Palestine doesn't exist. The Pakistani representative called the decision momentous, adding, quote, "For over six decades, Palestinians have proven to be superb human beings, but have regrettably remained without their rights. Today, this wrong has been righted." The representative from Sri Lanka said that with its vote, UNESCO, quote, "acted precisely as the conscience of the world community. I think that showing Palestine's independence is an idea whose time has come, and that this has brought recognition to the world community. We have, in fact, bolstered all the efforts with respect to a negotiated peace." Close quote.
Thanks to Steve Diamond for that news we need to know. You're listening to Making Waves, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. We have a song for you now by the Different Drums of Ireland, entitled "We've Got the Right."
Children of the world, sing loud and clear.
That was We've Got the Right by Different Drums of Ireland. You're listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. Now for an interview by Between the Lines, Independent Radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. This gives us an update on the Occupy Wall Street movement.
After 6 weeks of rapid expansion to cities and towns across the U.S., activists participating in the Occupy Wall Street movement witnessed some of the worst police violence on October 25th, when Oakland police reportedly used stun grenades, rubber bullets, and tear gas to disperse hundreds of mostly peaceful protesters exercising their right of free speech at an encampment near City Hall. In the midst of the Oakland clashes, former Marine and Iraq War veteran Scott Olson sustained a skull fracture when he was shot in the head by an unknown police projectile. In response to the aggressive police tactics, Occupy Oakland activists issued a call for a citywide general strike on November 2nd, where they invited all students to walk out of schools, the shutdown of the city's port, the fifth busiest shipping container port in the U.S., and a march in the downtown area outside banks, corporations, foreclosed homes, schools, and libraries. Some unions, including the Service Employees International Union, responded to the general strike call and are encouraging members to seek time off work to stand in support of the Occupy Oakland action. While the violence in Oakland captured headlines and sparked solidarity marches across the U.S. and the world, other police actions to evict Occupy activists occurred in many other cities, including Denver, Nashville, Atlanta, Chicago, and Cleveland. Your reporter spoke with journalist Arun Gupta, a founding editor of New York City's Independent newspaper, and a co-founder of the Occupied Wall Street Journal, a newspaper published by activists in the occupied encampment in Lower Manhattan's Zuccotti Park. Here, Gupta talks about the reasons why he believes the Occupy protests have expanded so rapidly, and the effect of police tactics to suppress the new movement decrying corporate greed, economic inequality, and political corruption.
It has become an Occupy movement because people feel shut out, that they have no voice, they have no say, they have no control. People I've talked to in this occupation tour, me and my partner Michelle Fawcett have been doing, we've been to 10 different cities, and you hear variations on a theme, that my voice doesn't matter, my hands are tied, I have no control over my life. So you find a lot of people who are suffering, you know, that they have medical problems and can't get health insurance, or they've lost their job, or they're homeless, and they're part of the Occupy movement. But it's also an expression of the lack of social and political space to have a democratic voice. And I think this is why it has grown so explosively. There's something like over, 300 active occupations across the country, and then there's maybe close to 2,000 places where there's kind of people who are actively doing something in terms of having meetups or having like a regular weekly event or something to that effect. And it's really tapped into a deep well of anger and resentment, but also a lot of hope and inspiration, and that's why it's grown so explosively.
Over the past week, we've seen increased police crackdowns on the Occupy encampments all over this country, in Denver, Tennessee, Chicago, and certainly worst of all in Oakland, where there was wide reporting of the police violence there to evict Occupy activists from a park in Oakland. We saw the injury of Iraq War veteran Scott Olson, who sustained a serious skull fracture as a result. And those activists there in Oakland are now calling for a general strike on November 2nd. Where do you think all the police protester conflict is leading to? And how much does it really distract from the message that the protesters are out there to work on in the first place?
One of the definitions of the state is it has a monopoly on violence. And so it's not surprising that you're going to see police departments reacting with various degrees of force. I think what's interesting is how they react differently. And in New York, certainly, it was the police violence that actually built the movement. September 24th, that Saturday, that's where you get the infamous viral video of an officer nicknamed Tony Baloney who goes up and pepper sprays those women in the face who are doing nothing but standing on the sidewalk. Then the following week, you had the 700 arrests on the Brooklyn Bridge. And I was down Zuccotti nearly every day. And after the Monday afterwards, you saw just explosive growth in terms of how the movement was taking off and the media response. What's going on in Oakland, that backfired also in terms of that has isolated the mayor and the police force. And to my understanding, at least a few days ago, to people who I was talking to, is there is a small occupation back there. Denver and Nashville, Denver it appears to have been more successful. Same with Atlanta. Nashville, though, you actually have a judge who's issued orders stopping the police from arresting people because he's saying that the curfew order is illegal. Chicago and then Cleveland are very different cases as well. Cleveland, they have managed to pretty much shut down the occupation. They're allowed to have a tent there 24 hours, but only one tent. Chicago, the protesters cannot even take a space, and the city hasn't reacted violently. But at the same time, also, you know, let's realize we're talking about maybe less than 10 cities when you have probably over 300 occupations.
Where do you see this movement headed in the next couple of months, in these harsh winter months coming up? I'm sure there's a lot of strategizing going on. We also hear some talk about, you know, coordination nationally, maybe a convention of some type this July 4th, some kind of horizontal democratic process to come up with a list of specific demands and tactics in order to make those demands real across the country. What are you hearing?
Well, when I go around to cities, and cities I've been to include Detroit, Chicago, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Toledo, Allentown, Youngstown, D.C., Baltimore, I ask people, so what about this convention? And to tell you the truth, only one person has heard of it. You know, the movement is going through certain growing pains that are very important. I think one of the biggest questions on the table, this is looking out a year, is the relation to the 2012 election, because you have a lot of liberal groups and unions who can be counted on to be kind of the ground troops for Obama, and the Democrats right now are very much supporting the Occupy movement. But what's going to happen come next summer? I've heard some people say, like, occupy the conventions. And, you know, I think that's a good idea for the Occupy movement, speaking as an observer, that it should be taken to the convention sites themselves, because, you know, it's a two-party system, though really there's only one party, the corporate capitalism, and people should be taking the protests right up to these two parties that are two wings of the same problem. How do you translate this into action? Is it policies? Is it institutions? Yes and no. You need to meet people's needs, right? Getting back to the original thing that, you know, people need health care, they need jobs, they need housing, they need education. But is it going to happen through the same norms, just through redistribution? Or do we need to fundamentally think about a restructuring of social relations, of economic relations, of what is work like, what is society like? I think that's more the answer, but that's much more difficult, and it has to be something that happens in the doing and the making over time, but it's not going to be easy by any stretch.
That was journalist Arun Gupta, a founding editor of New York City's independent newspaper. For more news, analysis, and commentary on the Occupy Wall Street movement, visit our Between the Lines special Occupy Wall Street coverage and resource page at btlonline.org.
Thanks to Between the Lines for that interview updating us on the Occupy Wall Street movement. Now for a bit of music. First, David Rovix with We Are Everywhere.
I say the hungry should have food. I speak for many when I say no one should have seven homes. While some don't have any, though I may find myself stranded in some strange place with naught but a vapid stare, I remember the world and I know. We are everywhere. And I say the time for the rich, it will come. Let me count the ways. Victory. boundaries or hints of the future. Havana, Caracas, Chiapas, Buenos Aires. How many people are wanting and waiting and fighting for their share? They hide in their ivory towers, but we are everywhere. Religions and prisons and races, borders and nations, FBI agents and congressmen and corporate radio stations. They try to keep us apart, but we find each other, and the rulers are always aware that they're a tiny minority, and we are everywhere. With every bomb that they drop, every home they destroy, every land they invade, comes a new generation from under the rubble saying, we are not afraid. They will pretend we are few, but with each child that a billion mothers bear, comes the next demonstration. We are everywhere. We are everywhere. We are everywhere.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. That was David Rovics singing We Are Everywhere. And now for Papa Wemba with Salakeba. You're listening to Making Waves. We next bring you another Between the Lines interview, this one focusing on the Congressional Super Committee and its threats to slash social safety net programs.
As a result of a deal reached in negotiations to break the impasse over raising the nation's debt ceiling in August, the so-called Congressional Super Committee was formed, composed of 6 Democrats and 6 Republicans, half from the House and half from the Senate. The committee is charged with making cuts or increasing revenue to reduce the nation's deficit by at least $1.2 trillion over the next 10 years. The panel must reach a bipartisan agreement, then pass the recommendation onto Congress by November 23rd. If the panel cannot reach a deal, that failure would trigger automatic cuts in domestic and defense spending in the 2013 federal budget. Press reports on leaks from the secretive deliberations of the supercommittee say the panel's Democrats proposed a grand bargain of spending cuts and new taxes worth up to $3 trillion. The recommendation reportedly included $400 billion in cuts from Medicare, $80 billion in cuts to Medicaid, and increased taxes on high-income brackets while eliminating some deductions for upper-income earners. Social Security is also on the chopping block, with a proposal to significantly reduce benefits through a switch to what's called the Chained Consumer Price Index. With Occupy Wall Street movement protest against corporate greed gaining support around the country, and a new Congressional Budget Office report highlighting data on rising income inequality over the last 30 years, the Democrats' proposal has provoked widespread opposition. Your reporter spoke with Eric Kingson, co-director of the Strengthen Social Security campaign, a coalition of 300 national and state organizations. He explains why he believes the failure of the supercommittee may be the best option for citizens fighting to protect federal social safety net programs.
The newspapers reported that a majority of the Democrats on the committee were open to considering cutting the cost of living adjustment into the future and making major cuts in Medicare. And they were committed to that on the basis that they might get some revenues from the Republicans. Of course, the Republicans came back and said, oh, we're sort of all for those cuts and we'd like them to be bigger, but, you know, you're asking for too much in revenues, and they're really asking for very little. The proposal the Democrats put forward, hopefully it's just a trial balloon and they'll back off of it, especially if all of your listeners send notices and calls to their senators and to the representatives. The proposal is just plain outrageous. It's more conservative than what the president proposed to Mr. Boehner earlier in the summer and that the speaker rejected. The major problem, putting aside conservative, liberal, the proposal that's being put forth and that's being discussed by the supercommittee in terms of Social Security, one of the major concerns is if they change the way they calculate the cost of living adjustment, it means that every single beneficiary will be getting a little bit less every year into the future. And that adds up so that after 10 years of receiving Social Security benefits, it would be the equivalent of about a $700 cut in year 10, say when you're 75. After 20 years, it would be the equivalent in year 20 at age 85 of about a $1,000 cut. And if you live to age 95, which some of our people are fortunate enough to do, it would be a cut in your 95th year of $1,400 in comparable money today. So it's taking a very modest benefit, which is an average of $14,000 for retirees or so, and saying, we're going to let inflation eat away a little bit. They say they have a better inflation measure, but they really don't. It's just a technical game to reach into the pockets of Social Security beneficiaries and pull the equivalent of $112 billion out of those pockets over 10 years.
Eric, what happens if this super committee cannot reach an agreement? There are some automatic cuts that take place both in the domestic and defense spending budgets. What would be better from where you sit in terms of these deep cuts to the entitlement programs, the Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, or how deep and awful will the automatic cuts be?
Let me just say, nothing good is going to come out of the super committee and out of this deficit ceiling decision. We shouldn't be having this discussion. As I said, we ought to be looking at putting Americans back to work and how to make prudent decisions short-term to spend more to boost the economy and boost demand, and then look out into the long-term at how to deal with projected deficits. And much of the problem of the long term has to do with rising health care costs, which we have to get control of as a nation. So nothing good is going to come out of it. Probably the best thing from my point of view that can come out of the super committee is deadlock. And the reason for that is, if that happens, there will be automatic sequesters, automatic pulling back of $1.2 trillion. Half will come out of defense, half will come out of domestic spending, but they protect Social Security, they protect programs for low-income people like Medicaid, SSI. They partially protect Medicare. They say Medicare can be cut by up to 2%, but it can only be cuts that affect the providers. So if nothing happens, that's what happens, and it doesn't go into effect until 2013, even possibly later. So we can have a presidential election and congressional elections that debate whether we ought to be talking about letting the Bush tax cuts expire, whether we ought to be talking about, as some have proposed, placing higher taxes on those Americans who've done most well in the past few years, and really asking those who crashed the economy to make a very serious contribution to rebuilding the economy.
That was Eric Kingson, co-director of the Strengthen Social Security campaign. Learn more about the coalition's work to protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Thanks to Between the Lines out of Bridgeport, Connecticut, for that interview. Next on Making Waves, we hear Media Minutes, news at the intersection of media and democracy.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
A group of AT&T shareholders are asking the company to commit to net neutrality principles on its wireless network.
We think network neutrality is important for the health of the economy broadly. And since many of our investors are diversified investors who have holdings in many, many companies, not just media companies, they think it's important that there be an open and robust internet. And so therefore, network neutrality principles are important.
Michael Connor is the executive director of the Open Media and Information Companies Initiative. The nonprofit works with companies and shareholders to develop more responsible and responsive media management practices. Open Mic has filed a proposal for shareholders to vote on net neutrality issues at the annual shareholders meeting in April 2012. Institutional and private investors have signed on, including Mike D. of the Beastie Boys.
When investors speak to the company as investors and speak to them because they think that this is going to be good not just for consumers, but also for the company and its shareholders in the long term, the companies tend to listen.
AT&T will more than likely ask the Securities and Exchange Commission for permission not to include it on their proxy ballot. In years past, the SEC has said that net neutrality is not a significant public policy issue. Connor hopes the SEC will see it differently this time, but he's under no illusions that AT&T's policies will change next year. Open Mic's main goal is to influence the thinking around short-term profits versus long-term gains over time. Connor says the industry is changing quickly, and it's necessary to stay in the fight for an open internet over the long haul.
You need to look at it long-term for the company, long-term for the country, because if the national economy suffers, if we do damage to the internet and we discourage small businesses and we make it difficult for small businesses and individuals to use the internet, and if the national economy suffers, ultimately AT&T's business will suffer.
Open Mic educates and informs the investment community about net neutrality issues. The group plans to bring their proposal to other wireless companies in the future.
We don't necessarily think that there's a contradiction between responsible media management practices and profits. If you look long term, open internet policies, more responsible management practices are really important both to these companies and to the country.
To find out more about Open Mic, go to openmic.org.
And here are two updates about our Federal Communications Commission. Last Thursday, the FCC announced that it will move toward digitizing public files and improving program reporting requirements for broadcasters. Broadcasters are not only supposed to serve their local communities in exchange for use of the public airwaves, they're supposed to be transparent about how they do it. These reporting requirements haven't been updated since the 1980s, and media watchdog groups say broadcasters either don't provide useful information to the public or the information isn't accessible to the public. The FCC is hoping to bring broadcasters into the digital era and provide the public with useful information on the local TV stations licensed to serve them. Corey Wright, Policy Counsel for Free Press, said she is encouraged by the FCC's pledge to move swiftly on implementing much-needed reforms. Wright said by updating broadcasters' reporting requirements and putting them online for easy access by viewers, the FCC could significantly improve consumers' ability to hold broadcasters accountable for whether they're using the publicly owned spectrum to serve and inform their communities. President Obama this week nominated Jessica Rosenworcel and Ajit Pai as new FCC commissioners. Rosenworcel is currently a top advisor to Senator Jay Rockefeller, chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee. She would replace Democratic Commissioner Michael Copps, whose term expires at the end of the year. Pai, who served previously at the FCC in the Office of the General Counsel, is a partner at law firm Jenner & Block. He would replace Republican Commissioner Meredith Atwell Baker, who left the FCC to join Comcast last May.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. Now for Hidden Histories, reminding us of the origins of Veterans Day.
Hi, I'm Jack R. Johnson, and this is Hidden Histories.
Wherever the flowers go, long time ago, wherever the flowers go, young girls speak them, everyone.
Veterans Day, or Armistice Day, was originally set as a U.S. legal holiday to honor the end of World War I, which officially took place on November 11, 1918. In legislation that was passed in 1938, November 11th was, quote, dedicated to the cause of world peace and to be hereafter celebrated and known as Armistice Day. As such, this new legal holiday honored World War I veterans and presumably the end of the war to end all wars. Unfortunately, World War I was not the end of all wars, and less than 50 years later came World War II, then a host of other conflicts. In 1954, after much lobbying by veterans group, Congress formally recognized this and changed the official name of the holiday from Armistice Day to Veterans Day, in recognition of American veterans of all wars. Although the name was changed, much of the ritual surrounding Veterans Day is tied directly to its World War I roots. For example, many veterans still perform the so-called 11th hour ritual, which takes place at the 11th hour on the 11th day of November, the 11th month, signifying the moment peace was declared after World War I. It is also said that it is the time in which the soul of the American Legion was born. For the gastronomes, another ritual involves the delightful Italian dish ravioli. The holiday is often celebrated by having a ravioli meal. That's a tradition which dates back to the ending of World War I when President Wilson invited 2,000 soldiers to the White House, and he helped his staff cook ravioli. In his Armistice Day address to Congress, Wilson explained this simply saying, "Hunger breeds madness." This is Jack R. Johnson wishing you a full belly in a peaceful Veterans Day.
Where have all the soldiers gone? Gone to graveyards everywhere. Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British War. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't marching anymore. For I killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the little big farm. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars. It's always the young to fall.
Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers, so many others, but I ain't marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men. Now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars. It's always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with a saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, knew that I was learning that I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leader is screaming when they close a missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I ain't marching anymore. No, I ain't marching anymore.
Thanks to Hidden Histories for that reminder of where Veterans Day came from. And then a song by Phil Oakes, I Ain't Marching Anymore. You're listening to Making Waves, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. Let's hear a little more music. Sweet Honey in the Rock singing Study War No More.
Gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Study War No More. Next on Making Waves, we bring you Outside the Box from social justice activist Larry Danziger with resources for organizing and social change and WERU in Blue Hill, Maine.
Welcome, and thanks for choosing Outside the Box. Today's topic is A Choice, Not an Echo. About a year ago, I suggested to listeners that they shouldn't vote for candidates in elections, especially if they didn't believe there was anyone worth voting for. I still believe that, since in most races, there are only two choices, which often seem like Tweedledee and Tweedledum, a.k.a. Republicrats and Democrats. Even when there are more than two choices, the range of options may seem only slightly better. When candidates completely ignore or barely mention the transformative changes we need in our communities, they won't get my vote. if you hold your nose when you vote, why vote either? We'll just keep spinning our wheels with politicians who don't want to tackle root causes and real solutions. When I suggested last year that people shouldn't vote if they didn't find anyone worth voting for, a lot of listeners were outraged. "I won't give up my right to vote or our country's democratic process," some said. For those who can't give up their attachment to voting, no matter how bad the candidates, here's another approach. Many people are registered with a political party, either Greens, Republicans, or Democrats. If you're not satisfied with any of the candidates from your party or any other party, then disenroll from your party and re-enroll as an independent. And if you're already an independent, stay that way. But don't just do it quietly. Make some noise about what you've done. Tell the local newspaper that you disenrolled. Tell your friends, family, and coworkers. Put it on the web and tell your Facebook friends. You can tell the candidates and the political party that you're fed up with the abysmal quality of the candidates and their positions. If you're currently an independent, tell everyone why you aren't going to change. You might disenroll after a primary election if a candidate lost who you really wanted to win. You might do it before the primary if none of the choices are worth voting for. You can do it today. Even if you like one candidate, but the rest of the party nominees were in the hold-your-nose category, that would be enough to dump the party. You could still vote for one person who you thought really could do something good for the state or country. The economy is in the toilet. Our country is at war with the world. Education is now a 30-year mortgage on your life. And we may not live as long as our parents. The same old, so-called solutions won't work anymore, if they ever could. If we're going to give power to a few so-called representatives to make decisions that affect everyone, then we better find creative, outside-the-box people with the courage to advocate real transformation. If you're registered to vote and enrolled in a political party, would you consider disenrolling and re-enrolling as an independent? I'm Larry Danziger, still not willing to vote for a lesser of evils.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome and need your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our ending music is Avalon by Amethystium. You can live stream our show if you are not in range of the station by going to www.portsmouthcommunityradio.org. Remember that WSCA is your community radio station and needs your support to remain on the air. Go to www.portsmouthcommunityradio.org to join and learn more. Ongoing technical improvements for Making Waves also need your help. Go to our website to find out how, www.nhmakingwaves.org. Tune in next Saturday for our next Making Waves program. We leave you with this quote by King Hussein I of Jordan. "It would behoove the world to become used to this fact, that without a just solution to the Palestine tragedy, there can be no stable peace in the Middle East."